What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
This episode, I have the pleasure of speaking with Bill Taylor. Bill is a U.S. Marine who served in Vietnam. He wrote an incredible book, which is biographical in nature, called On Full Automatic, Surviving 13 Months in Vietnam. In it, he describes his boots-on-the-ground experience in the bloody conflict that was known as Operation Beaver Cage, and having to deal with the trials and tribulations of losing his fellow Marines and then the post-traumatic stress that would follow thereafter. He was holding this all in for over 50 years, and now, for the first time, Taylor has shared all these experiences in this book, which I read, I absolutely loved, and I would recommend it to anyone who has even a passing interest in history. I spoke with him for about an hour. It was a real pleasure, and I hope you enjoy. And now I give you Bill Taylor.
Okay, I am here with Bill Taylor. Bill, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure being here. It really is. My pleasure.
Oh, thank you. No, the pleasure is on this side of the mic, I assure you. No, I'm very excited to have you on, Bill. I want to discuss, obviously, your experiences in Vietnam. Certainly, I want to discuss your book on Full Automatic, Surviving 13 Months in Vietnam. But before we get into all that, please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you, kind of who you are and what you're doing now.
Well, so I've reinvented myself over the years, and I went from commodity broker 10 years ago. I started my own real estate company with my son-in-law, Rossi and Taylor Realty out of Northwest Indiana. And 3.5 years ago is when I actually semi-retired. I needed to get the book written, so I became an author and also became a publisher. I started Deepwater Press, and now I've got my audio book. So right now I'm marketing my book and the audio. Very soon it'll be out in about 2 weeks. And I'm really excited about it, getting lots of, I get emails and calls from people. My website is, I can't believe how many people are responding. So it's exciting being an author and also being not only an author, but an author of a very successful book so far.
Yeah, that's excellent to hear. Yeah, I can side with you. I went on Amazon to look at the reviews on your book, and it's been pretty much across the board, yeah. 5 stars. It's extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that.
Yeah.
Also, under Kindle Unlimited Library, where the people just like rent a book and then send it back and then rent another, over 2 million pages have been read, and it didn't go to Kindle until August. Mm-hmm. So since last August, which is about 6 months ago, 2 million pages have been read. Oh, way over 2 million pages.
Wow.
That's incredible in itself. It says a lot about the book itself.
It's wonderful. Congratulations on that, Bill. Oh,
thank you. Thank you so much.
So winding the clock back then, Bill, why is it that you joined the war effort?
You know, it's interesting. I didn't join the war effort. What I did was, I was in 1966. I graduated from high school. I was 18 years old. I needed a place to go. Mm-hmm. It was either go to college or go to find a skill somewhere, learn a trade. And I thought about it, and they were drafting guys. And I thought, well, you know, I asked my friends, what was the best service to get into? And everybody was saying, oh, the Marines are the best. So I ended up joining, and I had the biggest, a lot of guys will tell you they had a shaft job from the recruiter. what happened was, you know, I said, what about this Vietnam War to the recruiter? And he goes, oh, this is the United States. Give me a break. You know, he goes, we'll have that thing over by the time you're out of boot camp. So I go, oh, yeah, okay. And I negotiated with him. I wanted aviation. I wanted to like fix helicopters and maybe go to O'Hare Field and work on helicopters out there. I just love to be able to work building a trade for myself in the airline industry. And I was in the airline industry, but I was a passenger on a helicopter going into combat. So it didn't work out the way I thought it was going to work out. So,
yeah, certainly.
I didn't intend to, but you know, I was willing to fight for my country, obviously.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's, but the motivation was looking for a place to go. And I think a lot of people, a lot of young people today are, they would join the service also, you know, to, you know, get the best training and, you know, be possible.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, as you might imagine, Bill, with a podcast like Eyewitness History, one of my goals, as it were, is to basically put the listeners there. And I'd like to know, what was your mindset like when you were first boots down in Vietnam? What were you feeling? Can you recall?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, first of all, my first boots down was in Okinawa. I met my battalion, 1st Battalion, 3rd Marines there. They had brought this battalion of Marines from Quezon to Okinawa to be trained as a Special Landing Force Helicopter Assault Group. Well, not only were we training for helicopter assault, we also mic boats and Amtraks, you know, getting on and off ships. So they trained us for at least 6 to 8 weeks of hard, intense training. And that's where I first had my experience of Vietnam. But I remember being on the USS Okinawa going towards the shore. And I remember walking through the center of the Okinawa, you know, waiting in line to get on the helicopters. And, you know, the adrenaline's flowing, you know, you're going in, you've been trained, you know what you're going to do. You had the old salts who knew what they were doing, and you had this whole new group of new people joining it to bring this battalion of Marines. That's 1,350 Marines.
Wow.
You know, at one big, large group and 4 companies of basic infantry and 1 company of weapons. And so they divided the weapons up into the different companies, and then they divided it up into the different platoons. And we're on the helicopters. I mean, you have no idea what it feels like, the adrenaline. It's almost like a carnival ride. Mm. You know, for the first time, you're getting up and you're starting to, you know, go in the helicopter, and it's shaking like it's going to tear apart. And then all of a sudden it smooths out. Cold air rushes in. You got fumes going into your face. And then as you're lifting off the helicopter in a group, as your group lifting up, all of a sudden you look off and you see the USS Sanctuary or the USS Repose sitting off into the distance. You know, so you feel like, oh, is this a good thing or a bad thing? I mean, good because it's there, bad because obviously there's going to be a problem. Otherwise, it wouldn't be following us around.
Right.
And then, of course, coming in the hot choppers go really high into the air. And as we were starting to land, I remember in Okinawa, we trained. It was about 80 degrees, 85 degrees, the hottest. When we hit that ground early that morning, it was so hot, and it was early in the morning. And, you know, we jumped off the helicopters and we went up and set up a perimeter. And of course, just like you see, and we were soldiers, you know, they would just take off and in kind of a tandem one after the other. And now you're standing there by yourself. The word came down, they didn't take us far enough into where they were supposed to. So we had to walk an extra like 5 miles just to get to the spot we were supposed to be at. Wow. And it was so hot. Guys were drinking water. I mean, you know, the thirst. And you're carrying 50, 60 pounds of gear. I mean, you got this helmet on. You got your flak jacket. And I remember, I mean, first hands on the ground, it was really, you felt strong and powerful and everything else. But once you got to a point, well, first of all, that first day, this guy started passing out. I mean, heat exhaustion. We just couldn't move. It got to be so bad that they brought some of the helicopters back just to take guys up in the air and bring them back down to cool them off. That's how bad it was.
Wow.
And we were in this valley, and there's supposed to be at least another full regiment. That means 3,500 North Vietnamese coming into this area, and they're supposed to like get their food. This area was North Vietnamese and Viet Cong friendly. They didn't like Americans. I mean, they weren't for us. So whenever you ran across anybody, they were just like, get the heck out of our way. And, you know, our battalion was sweeping up the valley, all the companies sweeping up the valley and like a straight across. And there was 3 other battalions that were already in the hills sweeping around. So what we're trying to do is get this 3,500 NVA pretty much trying to trap them up there.
Right.
And so I remember the first time we're going in the valley, and then they started shooting. Like, we got into this area where it was like, it wasn't jungle, but it was very heavy brush. And all of a sudden, the AK-47 started coming at us. And I got to tell you, we practiced for this. We practiced, but there's nothing like someone trying to kill you. It's a whole different feeling altogether. I mean, the adrenaline's flowing and you're getting down and you're like, you know what you're trained to do, but you're terrified at the very same second. So, you're hiding behind a log and I'm just spraying fire out there I can't see what it is, but if we're going to try to scare the hell out of them, shoot as many rounds as you can. So all that was, we didn't know it at the time, but that was just a delaying tactic that they used. They would slow us up so they could set up to see where we were going and pass the word so they could set up ambushes and things like that. So, of course, you go a little further and, all of a sudden you're in the open and there's a little hill in front of us. We're starting to climb this first hill and I heard the bloop, 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 bloop sound. It's just exactly bloop, bloop. You're hearing it. And being a new guy, I don't know. What the heck is that sound? They're blooping. And all of the old salts are saying, hit the dirt, hit the deck. And it's like, they're down. And we're all standing there going, what for? And all of a sudden you hear them go over your head. And it's like, oh, wow. I mean, that's the first learning, hearing the bloop. And so from then on, if you heard that sound, you got right down just like the old salts did. So, it's a learning process that happened to me in Vietnam. Just every little thing we did was just learning. And this whole battalion was learning. Also, all of the sergeants. And we had great leadership, great sergeants, great squad leaders, great platoon sergeant. He was phenomenal. And we had this gung-ho lieutenant who was, absurd. At least we thought he was absurd because, all he wanted to do was, charge. And we know, from just watching TV, that doesn't always work. You got to think first. So it was difficult. It was difficult for us all. And then, of course, as the day lingered on, more guys, heat stroke. I think we lost a good 80 guys from heat stroke. We lost them for a day and they had to bring them back out later. Their eyes rolling in the back of their heads and stuff like that. No more water. After the first day, people were drinking all their water and I was just trying to baby my water. And I was big legs, big, strong guy. So I was able to kind of hump where, I was on the football team. I was on the basketball team. I was in all these sports. And I think that helped me, push through all that stuff where, if you didn't have that, you just kind of drank your water and didn't care. Well, that also taught us how to really start sharing, not drinking as much water and guzzling water or trying to lose water like you're going to pour it on yourself. It becomes a very valuable commodity.
Yeah.
So that's the first experience of like my first day.
Wow. Thank you, Bill. That's extraordinary. In the opening chapters, your book reads, begin quote, "Our first operation was to be called Operation Beaver Cage. God only knows who came up with the name, but this was it. We were going to do what we had trained to do, find and kill the enemy." End quote. In plain words, Bill, would you please tell me what Operation Beaver Cage was?
Yes. So Beaver Cage, we were going to stop them from getting food. So we had to search all the different villages and we found tons of rice. We destroyed rice. We took rice out on helicopters to feed the people in the cities, the poor people. Mm. So we found punji sticks. We would find... of course, then they would lay traps for us and bombs and guys were, getting blown up and stepping on punji sticks and stuff like that, going through, hedgerows and one of these little mines go off and bouncing Bettys out there. So, we're working our way trying to get them and they're seeing where we're going and they're laying traps everywhere while we're trying to get there. And of course, you learn after a while. And so Beaver Cage was basically going after this big unit. And what usually was is all along the coast, it was like flat land, rice paddies. And then there was these big valleys, but it was in way in the west, there was these mountains and, like Hill 881 and all those. They're 800 feet high, but we looked at them as mountains and they were off into the distance and they were further west. And what we were doing was walking up the valley, going towards the mountains. And they were coming from the mountains. They were coming down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, going over the mountains. They were going to, hey, they're going to get their food, their supplies. We weren't going to let them have the supplies. We were going to cut them off. And that's exactly what we were doing. And what we were, all those other battalions were sweeping, and they thought that they could just come down the valley. And here comes, all of a sudden, we come in. Now we're sweep. We're the surprise. So that's exactly what we did. And that's exactly what we tried to do. Now, here it's very difficult when you're in a battle with these guys because they're stealthy. They're wearing black pajamas. They carry a machine gun and rounds of ammunition. They get their food from the villages. They don't have to carry shovels to dig holes. They've already made their places to sleep and everything. So there was just like, we had these heavy packs and we're slower, but we were huge and we had the firepower. And of course, when they would get us into a situation where they were going to like overwhelm us or something, our guys, you know, would bring in artillery, bring in the jets, bring in the helicopters, the napalm, the 500-pound bombs. And of course, you know, once we knew where they were at, then we could do that. And that's what our forward observers, we had really good forward observers that could call in airstrikes. And that's basically how, I mean, we won that bet. We did win that battle, but, you know, a lot of Marines got killed. We had one from our platoon only. We had several wounded, but at the same token, we killed 800 of the enemy and we stopped their food supplies, kept them from going into the valley. And a lot of other Marines and the other outfits were killed and wounded too. So, you know, there was a lot of Marines that were all involved and they got into the traps that we got into. You know, they led them the same way. They were very smart. They were good fighters. They were stealthy. They could move around real fast to our flanks and stuff like that. But we were lucky enough to be able to call in artillery and stuff in on them. So, wow. You know, they didn't have an easy job of it at all. And I wouldn't want to have been under napalm or 500-pound bombs, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely not. I know the book also specifies a mortar assault. Could you maybe kind of run through for our audience what that situation was like?
So, yeah, it's terrifying. That's all I can say, basically. and that is for the mortars. When we're up in the DMZ, they had rockets. They had different size mortars. They had artillery. I mean, artillery? Yeah, they were dug in on the other side of the DMZ and they would use artillery. Now, those are much larger explosions. But what they were using on us in the mortar barrage was, first of all, they approximate how many yards we were. And then they would send their mortars, you know, a series of mortars, and they would explode. And then they would adjust their fire to kind of narrow in on us. And of course, then they come closer and closer. And the closer they are, more chances of guys are of getting wounded and killed from those. And you know, it's like being in a thunderstorm when you're the worst part of the thunderstorm. You can't run anywhere and you're down on the ground and lightning is hitting. Bam, bam, bam. You know, it's just like, that's what the feeling is when you're getting hit with these bam, 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 bam. But the terrifying thing is, as they're walking him in, you could hear him getting closer, just like a storm of lightning. You hear it off into the distance and it takes maybe 5 seconds to get to you. Next thing you know, it's 3 seconds. Next thing you know, it's on top of you and it's going. That's just exactly the way the mortars. But sometimes you'll get 5, 10 minutes of mortars once they find out who you are. Well, it's our weapons guys that have to determine where these mortars are coming from, usually over a hill and there's a spotter. And that's what they assumed on Beaver Cage, is that they were just over the hill and they would set up the more our mortar crews would start sending the rounds and then they would, you know, walk them in on them. And then they would just grab their stuff and take off. So, and of course, we would be flanking them on the side. So, it was a constant way of playing a game and they knew how to play the game. They played it so they didn't die. They didn't want to die. Right. So they would just stop us and then they would take off. Of course, you don't know if they're still there. You know what I mean? Do I get up? Do I not get up? There's a lot of guys who got up on a mortar barrage and then bang, all of a sudden one of these out of the clear blue sky comes and you didn't know about it.
That's incredible, Bill. Yeah. Wow. Put me right there. It gave me a shiver. I'd like to run through the beginning of chapter 3 reads, begin quote, After we mortared the Quezon?
Quezon Valley.
After we mortared the Quezon Valley and Lieutenant Sutton had flown to the USS Sanctuary, our first operation, Beaver Cage, was coming to an end. There were three more days of light contact, and then our battalion walked 20 miles to an extraction point where we were airlifted back to the USS Okinawa. We had lost only one Marine from my platoon, but several were wounded. In the whole battalion, 55 of our men were killed and 151 wounded. For us, it had been bad, but much worse for the enemy. We were told that we'd killed more than 800 and captured 37, end quote. Could you please, Bill, recall your mindset, how you processed the experience as you were being extracted?
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-218-6010. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-218-6010. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-218-6010.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
Sure. So 20 miles, that's quite a long way to walk. Mm-hmm. And we're going through a village. Then we're going through a rice paddy. Then we're going through a jungle. Then we're going through another village. And so we're going through bamboo, big fields of bamboo. We're going through elephant grass. We finally get to our location where we're at. And I think it really depends on who gets in the helicopter with you. So, you know, if you get a guy that's a jokester and we're getting ready to take off, that's what you're going to experience. You're going to experience like laughter. You're going to experience funny things to talk back about, maybe something that somebody had done, funny name for a person, whatever it is, you're taking off with that mindset. But then there's the other mindset of now, thinking about what it was that you just went through. You almost go into the
thousand mile stare.
You almost go into a 1,000-mile stare. You're looking out and looking out of the helicopter as you're taking off. You're just viewing out there and you're just kind of like running over everything that happened in your mind. And I know for a fact that once you're there and once you're going through that, you're terrified. You are so terrified. Once you get into that helicopter, you're feeling some semblance of safety, of you're going somewhere where you're finally going to be able to, you know, just calm down and be with your friends and have a good meal, because you haven't eaten a good meal in almost a month. All you've eaten is C rations. Mm-hmm. You've never had a hot meal in the field. You get water every 3 days with your meals, and that's about it. You know, you get your mail sometimes, and you just can't wait to get aboard ship. So your feelings, your thoughts, and all your emotions will vary at all these different times. Just like in combat, when you're in a combat situation, you will be like John Wayne. You'll be unbelievable. And then you'll be in just another week or two that passes. You'll be terrified and don't want to move. You'll be frightened, terrified. It's all your state of mind at the moment. And you can tell the intensity from the battle because of the smells of the battle. You know, the cordite and the bodies that have been out there and the smells. And, you know, all of that stuff resonates in you. And you go through it for 13 months. You come out of this whole experience like, you know, it doesn't never leave you. Never leaves you.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate that very much. I'd like to move on to chapter 5. You actually discussed an experience which I could only visualize as that scene from Born on the 4th of July, which I'm sure has crossed your mind. Maybe you could elucidate this for our audience a little bit.
Well, you know, it's my book is not about battle. It's about the battles I was in, mm-hmm. but it's also about the experiences that I had. And that's what makes this book so real. And one of the things is, this part about a baby. And just, I'm learning, and by chapter five, I mean, months are going by. I'm starting to learn how to really become a really good Marine. I'm learning that, I know where the snipers are going to hit us at, or, you just get a sense, your senses start coming into play. And we were crossing this ravine, and in this ravine was the weeds that were just as high, so it was like five or six foot ravine that we had to cross. And in it were reeds that came to the very top. And it almost looked like it was invisible. And as we all crossed it, I mean, we're all sweeping across this area in Vietnam. And as the creek went to my left, and the guys to my left were already in the creek bed, I was getting ready to go in the creek bed, and the guys to my right were going to be getting ready. So it was on an angle, and guys were already coming out, and the whole battalion is sweeping. And I got inside there, and I looked around. I had a sense something was wrong. I felt like there could be 100 Vietnamese in here ready to kill us. I mean, the way you could hide in this thing. I mean, it was overgrown, so there was like a place where they could actually hide. And I decided to really quickly check this thing out. And I just walked through it real quick. And all of a sudden I heard a sound, and that became the beginning of this with the baby. I found a baby inside like a cave, and I pulled it out, and everybody around me is going, laughing. And I mean, comments like, "Hey, Bill, you got the smallest, BC in the whole wide world, I captured a baby BC." And it just was like very touching. I was looking, it was all wrapped up, and as I opened it, it was a little boy, and it was just a small, he was just so small. He was like 1 year old. He was just at that point where he's like starting to recognize things and really coming out, maybe one and a half. And I remember that everybody was mad. I mean, the company commander came over, the sergeant, the lieutenant, everybody was yelling at me. And they said, "Well, Taylor found a baby. What do you want him to do?" And, they wanted to get this thing moving, so just bring the baby along. Well, I didn't want to leave the baby. I this belongs to somebody. They put that baby in that cave for a reason. I wanted to disobey orders and not take the baby, but they told me I was in charge of the baby until we can have it flown out. And I could just see this baby ending up in an orphanage, and my heart was going out, and I'm a Marine. I'm supposed to be tough. I'm supposed to be, I just grab this baby, walk. No, I'm very compassionate. And that's what starts with the baby. And I become so attached to the baby, because we had to go for 2 days before the baby was going to be medevaced. I had to have food for the baby. I had to figure out a way to feed it. I had to figure out a way to keep it warm, and the baby considered me sanctuary. The baby would not go to anybody but me, stayed with me, slept with me, just hung on to me, and I made sure. And everybody started loving the baby. The big guys were coming over, and they were, one of them made a puppet for the baby and had the baby laughing. And it was just, and so I got so attached, and this baby was making everybody, it almost gives you a sense of home. You know what I mean? It gives you a sense of not being in a war zone anymore.
Humanity.
It's a humanity. And so, then came the time. I was in the morning of the next day, and I could hear the chopper in the background. And, I knew it was coming, and they're all saying, "Bring the baby to the, to the landing zone." And I'm welling up, and I'm starting to like cry and trying to get, I'm even feeling myself right now well up about this child. So I got a note, and I put in a note, my address, I want to adopt the baby. I wanted to do something for the baby. And it's an in-depth story that really grabs your heart. And of course, then when I had to give up the baby, it was like the worst in the whole world. And I just wanted out of the war. I just wanted out of this whole thing. I just hated everything about where I was at. And it was very difficult, because through this whole process, I was very naive Marine when I first started out on Beaver Cage, very naive and didn't know anything. And then by the time of the baby, I was really starting to wonder why we're even there. You know, why are we even here in this, fighting this war? And it made me feel like, you know, all I wanted to do was just get home. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go home. So it became a battle for me to survive, to make it out of Vietnam, but always to know that I have to support my fellow Marines. But the whole thing about the Vietnam War is, who were we fighting? This is, I came up with this determination at that time, somewhere around there, where I said, okay, so who we're fighting? The North Vietnamese, and they're trying to take over the South. And then we were fighting the Viet Cong. Who are the Viet Cong? They were the South Vietnamese. So I thought we were trying to keep them, for, you know, save them. And here they hated us. All the farmers hated us. And not necessarily. They were in fear of liking us, because if they did like us, the Viet Cong would kill them, beat them, steal their food, would, you know, do all kinds of things to them. So they were not able to like us.
Sure.
And basically, I'm in this area. It's like 1,000 years ago area. I'm talking, these people live in huts. They're crude. They live on crude, just rice and the banana trees. They would eat once they gave the fruit, they would cut it down and eat a banana tree, because, you know, they didn't have a lot of vegetables. They didn't have like the farming we have today. And I don't think the soil would have supported it, but, you know, it was really, it was an eye-opening experience, and giving up that baby was one of the hardest things in my life. So, yeah.
Yeah. Wow, Bill. No, thank you so much for sharing. It's much appreciated. Obviously the war was, as you allude to, the war was, to use the fashionable term, polarizing, right? To say the least. I know it was the first, what you could call, really televised war. And I'm sure that played a role to a great extent. Once your tour ended, what was your experience like when you came back to the States?
Oh, it was a nightmare. It was a nightmare. So I remember when I finally made it home from Vietnam, I got off the airplane and I was one of the guys that got out of line and kissed the ground. I mean, you have no idea how much you appreciate life and America when you go through one of those experiences from one of these foreign countries. It's like these guys from Afghanistan and Iraq. They had the same situation. I bet you they couldn't wait to get back to normality in America. But then we came, and it was as if we ourselves were bad people and they were spitting at us. I mean, you didn't even want to wear your uniform. You didn't. It was a horrible experience to come home to America. You almost lose your life. You're fighting for your country. And what happens? You know, people spit on you. And that, believe me, that's no myth. That's no myth about, oh, yeah, you hear so many people. Yeah, there were so many people. They all, as a group, you walk through an airport, they would scream and yell baby killer at you. And, you know, I was a good soldier. If anything, I was a great soldier, where I cared about people. I cared about the old people. I cared about everybody. And you come home but, you know, the news had a lot to do with that. You know, they wanted to sensationalize the war. Mm-hmm. So what did they do? They focused on the My Lai massacre. Oh, this is what the soldiers are doing.
Right.
This is what they're doing. No, that's not what we were doing. But they sensationalized it. And when they did that, it just made it look like we were all bad people. And unfortunately, you know, I don't condone what they did, but I understand what they did. I wouldn't have done that. But when you go through combat and they do not take prisoners, they do not take prisoners. The North Vietnamese and Viet Cong, they would torture you and they would kill you. But they did not capture you at all. If you did get captured, it was for another reason, to take you somewhere so they could torture you and kill you there. So there was people who escaped that situation that were held for days, but there was a reason they were held for days, because if you look in the records, they're only the guys that were captured were the downed pilots and anybody with a large rank. They were kept. But the Viet Cong, So when you know you go through a village and you get fire from the village, and then you go through the village again later on and you get fire from the village, and then you go back into the village and all these people are standing there like, oh, I'm not doing anything, you know, and your buddy, the guy that you just created this relationship with, that you knew him like he was your brother, and he's dead because somebody killed him from that village right there. That's why some people crack, you know, I can understand a whole platoon cracked at My Lai and they just went and killed people. It was absolutely horrible. I wouldn't condone that in any way, shape or form. And I've never done anything like that and would never expect anybody to do anything like that. But when I say I understand it, I understand that people snap.
Sure.
Anything can happen when a person snaps. They lose their mind. It's wrong. And I'm sure it happens in war. I'm sure in World War II it happened, I'm sure. Afghanistan, I think it's happened everywhere where the soldier snaps. And you don't know who the enemy is. You know, we were supposed to learn from the Vietnam War. We didn't learn from the Vietnam War at all. We end up in Iraq. We didn't know who the friends, foe, we didn't know who anybody was. And then all of a sudden we're in Afghanistan. We don't know who friends are, who the foe is. I mean, they didn't want us there. The Vietnamese people didn't want us there. So why are we there? You know, that type of thing.
Right. Absolutely. And then just to, no, thanks, Bill. And then just to backtrack in terms of how you're treated when you arrived home and the media sensationalizing it. If my information was correct, and I heard you on a podcast earlier this week, you were paid a whopping $100 a month to serve. Is that correct?
That is actually, it's not correct. We got less than 100. I think it was like $97 or something when we first joined a month, which is terrible. I remember I didn't get a paycheck my first month because not only do you only get $97, but you have to pay for your toothpaste and your every single thing that you used in boot camp. So when you first are there, they give you a pail, they give you a brush, they give you toothpaste, they give you, but they're charging you. And it's not, you know, discount prices. You know what I mean? It wasn't discount prices.
It's a little funny only because it's so absurd. Yes. in my opinion.
So, and to give you an idea, a haircut. So you get a haircut, you know, oh, take a little off the sides. No, you get a baldy. You just, and you're getting charged as if you went to a hair salon. It was all union. It was all union barbers. It was all union. What a cushy job that was, you know?
Oh, that's funny. You know, I think it is important, Bill, that we talk a little bit about the after effects of war, which I know you go into in some detail in the book. If you'll permit me one more quote. In the book, you write, begin quote, "My incoherent screaming always wakes me up. As the ceiling comes into focus in the darkness above, I begin to feel the wetness in the bed beneath my 70-year-old body, soaked from sweat. I sit up on the side of the bed and stare into the carpet for a minute. My wife and I no longer sleep together because of these nightmares. In the bathroom, I see some old stranger in the mirror. The feeling of being that boy back in Vietnam with my platoon has not yet left me. I splash cold water on my face and keep my hands pressed there, pressing my fingers hard against my eyelids. It's not the first time I've relived the battle. And even now, 52 years later, I know it won't be the last," end quote. That paragraph may well have answered my question, Bill, but if you wouldn't mind, as best you can, expanding on it, how has the war experience affected you?
It never leaves me. I hear a helicopter way before everybody hears a helicopter. I mean, these memories, these thoughts, these visions. When I first came home, I remember screaming, waking up every single night. And the thing is, what a nightmare is about is it's not you dreaming. You are actually back in Vietnam. You are actually getting hit with mortars. You are actually, I mean, my body must be moving. I must be going, like, it's all a dream and it's just all like rattling and screaming in my head. And then all of a sudden the rounds are coming in or someone screams and you wake up and, you know, you sometimes you'll even, You just get this feeling, this like, oh yeah, and it's like it happened 5 minutes ago. You know, the war was 5 minutes ago, and I'm reliving it like it was yesterday. And some people might say, oh, come on, 50 years, get over it. No, right. No, that's not what it's not like, oh, you're right. You know, I can do that. No, it's not anything like that at all. It's just like, it's something you can't help. And, you know, it's just the little blip, like the helicopter. I hear it way before anybody else does. There's, I got my hypervigilance. Now, I'm not going to say the whole Vietnam experience was a horrid thing and it was all nightmares and everything. There's some of that stuff is kept me strong, kept me, you know, other people, oh God, my life is so miserable. I had a bad hamburger today. My boss yelled at me. It was like, give me a break. When you go through what the veterans have gone through, it makes you strong. It makes you, you know, give me a break. You know, someone complains about their food, give me a break. Try 13 months eating sea rations and see,
right.
And then going aboard ship and eating bacon that isn't fully cooked, you know, or something like that. It just doesn't bother you. You just, sure, it's nice to have a good quality meal and to enjoy yourself. But when you don't get that, or when you have to skip a meal, or when things get tough and your boss yells at you, all right, he yelled, so what? You know, maybe had problems with his wife today. I don't know. You know, as long as I know I'm doing the right thing. And then you're able to, like, you lost your job. All right, go find another one. I mean, you could sit there and whine and cry about the fact that you don't have a job, or you can say, well, maybe I'll take this as an opportunity to then go out and find a job. You know, it's maybe God is watching out for me and I don't even know it. So I don't have this one. I'm going to go for a better one. And that's what I've always done in my life. I've always reinvented myself. Through all the years, I just keep reinventing and reinventing and reinventing. When the commodity market, you know, I was in the commodities and the grain market, the wheat, corn, bean, meal, and oil over in the Chicago Board of Trade, it went electronic. I mean, it became a dinosaur. I had to do something different. I seen it. And that's what I did. I, you know, that Marine thing kicks in. That survival, I mean, you didn't have to be a Marine. You could have been Army. You could have been any Navy, whatever. You know, all that experience of going through those tough times make you stronger and a better person.
Oh, excellent, Bill.
Did I answer the question? I'm just wondering, did I answer?
No. I think you answered fine, how the war experience affected you. No, that's perfect. There's actually a quick story that I'd love to coax you to tell. I heard you say it on another podcast. I'd love for you to tell it to me and our mutual audience. But you told a story on another podcast about how one of the people that spat on you came up to you and apologized.
Right. Yes. You know, that's exactly what. So what it was is I've been getting news. I've been getting letters. I've been getting emails. And if people go to my website, they can see like 1,000 pictures, combat photos of Vietnam. I took 452, but my friends helped allowed me to share a lot of their photographs, too. And so what was the point I was trying to make? I just kind of.
No problem. The protester that.
The protester. So anyway, this protester. So I get an email out of the clear blue sky, and it was this woman. And she said, you know, I was a protester during the Vietnam War, and I feel so terrible. And I was hoping you'd forgive me. And I want to apologize and tell you that I was just following the crowd and I read your book and I had no idea what you guys were going through. And I want to apologize and I want to beg your forgiveness. And that shocked me to get this email like that. And this, so it shows that not only, and then there was another incident. So I was on, I think the podcast that you're talking about is when I was with, in 1986, Joe Klein wrote a book called Payback, Five Marines After Vietnam. And I'm one of the Marines that are in the book, and it talks about Operation Cochise when we got the whole platoon got ambushed and there was only seven of us left. So I was on an airplane for the promotion of Payback, and we were all going to meet in New York City and do the tour of, you know, all of the downtown area. We even went to the exchange, and they actually stopped the exchange for us. I mean, it was just amazing time there. And so I was talking to the guy that was on a plane next to me, and I was telling him all about the book and, you know, about the battle I was in. And, you know, I was this Vietnam veteran. And when I got off the plane, this lady caught up to me and she came up to me and said she wanted forgiveness for being a protester. And that shocked me because I didn't realize that, you know, maybe some of these people, they were just following the crowd.
Right.
And that's what this lady had done. She was following the crowd and she felt so bad that she had protested the war. And she just kept on begging me for forgiveness. And I told her, I said, you know, we're both casualties of that war. You are and I am. And so, you know, obviously, I don't hold anything bad for you. You were doing probably what you thought you were doing right at the time. And I'm sure you did. And, you know, the war, it shouldn't have gone on. But, you know, I do realize that you had a difficult time. And I'm glad you were able to talk to me and that we were able to talk. So, yeah. And then she left. And that's all I ever saw of her. And now, I mean, I think a lot of these people realize that it's not the soldiers. Every time I go to a grocery store, I wear my cap, like I'm wearing my Marine Corps shirt right now. I'll go into a grocery store or something and someone will come up to me and say, thank you for your service. And believe me, it means a lot to us.
Yeah.
It really means a lot to the veterans when someone comes up and says that, because, you know, people don't realize how much we suffered over there. And guys are still suffering to this day. There's a lot of people. And now we're finding out it's not only the veterans that are suffering, it's some of those protesters that they have all these terrible, they realize that maybe what they did was wrong. They were one of the people that spit at us or called us baby killers or whatever. And we're all victims of that war, basically.
Yeah. Yes, without question, Bill. I want to call out, I know we have about 9 minutes left. I have just a couple questions left and then you're no longer my prisoner. How's that sound?
Sounds good.
So towards the end of the book, Bill, you recall a rather interesting back and forth with the lieutenant when you tried to turn in your M16. Maybe you could run through that quick.
Oh, my gosh. You know, so I finally got my third Purple Heart. It was in the last battle in January, on January 19th. It was just after Tet. And I thought, I didn't realize he put me in for, I didn't realize the corpsman had even put me in for a heart. I was in this horrible battle and it was an all day long battle. And I just had a little bit of shrapnel in my shoulder and he came over, took it out and bandaged me up and took off. And so here it's now this, I had to go into the DMZ, I had to run a patrol in the DMZ. And I was just devastated that a lot of guys were getting killed in the 13th month. And it's going into my 13th month and I could see me going into the DMZ. So many guys were killed in the DMZ. So many of my platoon were wounded and killed going out there. And I went up to the guy they called me in and I thought they were calling me in to tell me how to run the patrol. And he goes, you got your third Purple Heart came through. Get your stuff and get out of here. First chopper out. And I went, oh my God, I was so happy. I mean, I was screaming and yelling and I got out of the bunker and I was yelling and happy. I was going crazy. I finally got my stuff. I got to the point where I'm so happy. You have no idea how happy I was finally getting out of Vietnam. And I'm just like, I hope nothing, you know, like plane crash or helicopter crashes, something happens. And I finally end up dying. You know, what a heck of a situation. You know, what a just horrible thought. Right. And then finally, now I'm going in. Now I got to turn in my M16. I got to realize now my M16 jammed on me so many times in so many different battles that when it would jam, I would bust it against a tree and then I would pick up one of the M16s from the wounded or dead. And then I would use that weapon. And then something had happened and it would jam on me again and I'd bust it. I'd make sure it was always busted and I'd grab another one. And I did that several times. By the time I left, I was turning in my M16 to this boot lieutenant who apparently just got there and I handed it to him and he looks at the number and he looks on the sheet and he goes, this isn't the M16 that you're issued. And I go, yeah, duh. No, right. Yeah. I said, that's, you know, my jammed. I busted it. I took some from somebody else. He goes, well, you're going to have to pay for your M16. And I go, what? He says, yeah, you're going to have to pay for your M16. Well, you got to pay for the one that was issued you. I grabbed that M16 out of his hand so fast, and I said, then I'm keeping this one. He goes, you're not. I'm going to be yelling profanities at me, saying he's going to put me in the brig. I go, what? I don't do whatever you want to do. I'm leaving Vietnam. What are you going to do? Yeah, I'm out. I'm done. No more fighting for me. I don't care. I'm holding the M16. And I'm screaming at him, and he's screaming at me. And now, this is an officer. You don't scream at officers. You really don't. I had snapped, and I was yelling at him like he was a no-good, low-life person, and the captain come over. I recognized him. He had authority and everything else, and he goes, what the hell is going on here? I go, this asshole, excuse my language, he wants me to pay for my M16. I've got 3 Purple Hearts. I'm in so much combat. He looked at me, and he goes, just give me it and go on. Just leave. Just go. He goes, just go. I'm still trying to, I had all this anger going, and he goes, just go. And the lieutenant's looking at him, go, what are you doing? And he goes, shut up. You know, he was just like, he didn't even know what he, you know, so it was a way of like, it's still a goofy war. The whole thing's goofy. Yeah. Everything. It's just like, here we go. We got a comedy of errors going on everywhere you look, and I'm leaving Vietnam, and I can't even leave normally, just like a normal human being. So, by the way, the book was 140 pages, and I'm sorry, it was 140,000 words, and my editors told me I needed to cut it down to 90 or under 100,000. So it's a 97,000 words plus in there, but. Yeah, there's a lot of stories that were cut out, a lot of interesting things. But I think when it all comes down, I think that the book is, it's really hitting. I mean, the sales are through the roof. I can't even believe it. People are commenting, like you say, on the reviews, 114 reviews in just 6 months. It touches my heart. It really does when someone puts in a review and it's just all 5-star reviews. It's just very touching, let me tell you.
Yeah, no, absolutely, Bill. That's fantastic. So yes, so once again, the book is On Full Automatic, Surviving 13 Months in Vietnam. Bill, where can people get the book?
You know, it's on Amazon. You can get it from Amazon. You can also go to my website, onfullautomatic.com. And there's a place where you can click on and you can order it from there. They can contact me to direct if they want an autographed copy. Be more than glad to do that. You know, they just have to pay for the postage and stuff. So pretty much it's available. It's out there and it's selling like hotcakes.
Brilliant.
I'm very touched because, you know, We Were Soldiers is a very popular book and it was a great movie. And it's been going for some time and it has 3,000 ratings. And mine's already got a 1,100 and what?
Wow.
1,100 and some, and it's only 6 months old.
So, that's incredible.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely, Bill. Bill Taylor, how can people find out about you, sir?
Well, you go to my website, and it's also the same thing if they go to williamvtaylor.com. And I mean, there's a place where someone can write me if they'd like to, and if they have something nice they want, or if they want me to know something that they appreciated the book, or they didn't like it, or whatever. I'd love hearing from people. So, and I respond to every single one of them.
Awesome. So, awesome. Yeah. Well, I tell you, as I mentioned offline and over the course of the interview, as someone with 2 siblings in the military, one of whom is a Marine, I have nothing but respect for what you guys do and have done. And I cannot tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time from me, Bill.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, it's been a pleasure. It's been an enjoyable experience. And I love talking about my book. And thank you for that opportunity. That's for sure.
Oh, that's my pleasure, Bill. I will let you go, and I really appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on eyewitness history, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.